Welcome to the ADHD Alchemy Podcast, where women with ADHD finally feel seen, understood, and unapologetically themselves. If you have ever felt like you're too much and not enough all at the same time, you're in the right place because that's the alchemy, learning how both come together to make something priceless. I'm Jessica Covington, holistic ADHD coach and fellow fancy brain, and I'm really glad you're here. Let's get into it. Welcome to ADHD Alchemy. It's more than a podcast. It's also my signature coaching program at Fitology. It's perfect for bright, sensitive women who are tired of feeling scattered and chaotic and ready to feel calm, clear, and finally in control. What I found is that emotional overwhelm is one of the most overlooked but most important challenges of having a fancy brain like ours. Those moments are so flooded with feelings that we literally cannot think straight. And those moments are rough, to say the least. That's why I made a meltdown map just for you. It's a simple three-step reset that you can do anywhere, anytime you feel overwhelmed. You can download your free copy at fitology.com/meltdown-map. That link, of course, will be in the show notes. And today we have with us Gabriella Mooney. She is a stay-at-home mom. After founding and running an arts nonprofit for a decade, a traumatic injury and a toxic board forced her to pursue balance and community. She says she has done more jobs than reasonable for any human. It's relatable for a lot of us. She's chronically overbooked and describes herself as the secretary of fun. Motherhood completely shifted her perception of herself, and learning that her kids were differently wired forced her to learn new skills to help them, and that changed how she navigates the world. So Gabby, thank you so much for making the time. I'm really glad you're with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So motherhood led you to the realization that not everybody has the same internal experience that you do. And it's such a common theme that I see all the time. A mom starts learning how to support her kid and then begins to see herself in so much of what she learns. That was my own story, actually, and so many other women I've met too. Can you take us back to that very first moment that this really hit home for you?
You know, my whole life, I've kind of like thought that my brain works differently, but I think I attributed it to, oh, you're empathetic, or, oh, they tell you you're gifted in school and people always said I was smart. And as I got older, I would be like, oh, I'm so ADHD, but like, I didn't really know what that meant. I didn't really think about it, and it wasn't something in our childhood that was ever acknowledged. Like, it wasn't something where I could have said, hey mom, I think my brain's different, can I go talk to a doctor? She would have been like, take some broccoli pills, and that would have been that, you know. So when I had my oldest son, I was, you know, in a not great marriage. I was the only person in my friend group who was either married or had kids. I was running a nonprofit. I had a second business that I was running, where my son, because we could not afford childcare, came with me. So I was losing my mind. I remember being very, very overwhelmed and just feeling like the rage that I felt about being overwhelmed, like, couldn't possibly be normal. And I, you know, went to therapy, got diagnosed with postpartum OCD and depression. You know, I eventually like ended up in a research study for depression, but then they pulled me because I was too depressed. And it was just like, it never felt like anything was helping me. And then I got hooked up with this therapist who has changed my life. She's amazing. Who really helped me like kind of start to break down the idea that like who I was a problem. And then as my son got older and I started to notice that things that people were telling me that you should do with children just didn't work for him, it never even occurred to me that he might be neurodiverse at all. Never, not once. I just thought, oh, well, it doesn't work for him. Let's try something different. Because my whole life, that's what I had done. I had said, well, that doesn't work for me. I'm going to try something different. And as he got older, I just kept accommodating. I kept being like, okay, well, he doesn't like when we do things this way, so we're going to try it this way. And well, he really likes the structure, but he needs flexibility in the structure, so we'll try it this way. And it just kept going and going and going. And I want to say when he went to first grade and I was going through a really rough time after a traumatic injury, I was leaving the nonprofit that I had left or that I was, running. His teacher came to me, and I was very, very close with all of his teachers. I was involved in the school. And she was like, Max is one of the smartest, most wonderful kids in the entire world, and he cannot sit still. And I think you should get him evaluated. And I was like, oh, okay, sure. And I was like, why didn't I think about that before? And when he got evaluated and we got his diagnosis back, and he was ADHD and he was extremely high IQ, and I was like, oh, and it was like everything that he started expressing to me after we gave him his diagnosis, we told him his diagnosis. I'm like, this is how your brain works, and this is what we're going to do to try to help you. I was like, oh, wait, that's me when I was a kid. Wait, that's me when I was a kid. Wait, that's me when I was a kid. Like over and over. And I would be like, yeah, Max, I remember feeling like that when I was 8 years old, over and over and over again. And that was when it clicked for me. I was like, oh, wait. This whole time I've been jokingly saying I have ADHD, and I actually do have ADHD, which like is a disability. Like it is, which is not a dirty word. It's a disability, and that's okay. And I need to just be okay with that. And so that was when my whole like his diagnosis like just changed everything for me, because then I started looking at my 3-year-old and being like, oh, like we've been doing the same thing. And my husband works with children with special needs every day. Like his entire company is built on children with autism and ADHD and Down syndrome or other, different things. And he didn't clock it either, because we were just accommodating
Yeah.
the children in our home the way that we would accommodate, out of love and compassion, any child we were working with. So, and then realizing that I had been doing that for myself without ever really acknowledging that, like, it didn't have to be that way. I didn't have to keep creating things and not naming the thing that was the reason behind it.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never thought about it this way. So this thought isn't really fully baked yet, but it's almost like the accommodating that you were doing for your older child and then later your second is almost like the flip side of masking. When we are trying to observe everything around us and fit in and do the things that make us look and sound so-called normal, it didn't, I don't know, it's almost like creating a new normal for your child so that they can be who they are. It's like reverse masking in a way.
Yeah, and that was what was so interesting, is it wasn't until academically things got challenging for my child and he got bored at the same time that this started to come out at school. Because at school he was just, I mean, he was smart and he's a very kind kid, and so he never really had any issues. But when he started to get a little bit challenged but also bored, then at school he couldn't mask as well, because he had capacity to mask at school because he was never doing it at home. That was the thing that I realized later, as I was like, oh, he has been masking at school, but it doesn't tire him out, because when he comes home, he doesn't have to do any of that. He just like is whoever he is. And it was great in a way, because we did realize things much faster. Like we were able to pinpoint what was going on, and his teachers were incredible. Shout out to Miss Bell. But it really felt like that. It felt like, oh, we've just been doing such a good job of like working within what their brains need without realizing we were even doing it, that they didn't ever really have to do that at home. And no one, and because it was so normal to us, no one else was like, that's weird that your kid's doing that. Like no one ever said anything to that. Well, to be fair, we also have an incredible community of people around us who all are neurodiverse and have children who are likely that. So it was kind of like, oh, we're in good company,
Birds of a feather really do flock together, even when they don't know it.
Yes, I actually call the there's like two or three people in our friend group that like are not neurodiverse at all, and I call them the boring people as a joke. I'm like, oh, the boring people over there. They don't think it's very funny, but I do.
It's a term of endearment. I'm sure they know you mean it with love. So let's talk about that notion of disability. It's not a term I use in my vernacular. Those who know me know that I don't frame it that way, and I'll say more about that in a moment if I need to. But I really deeply respect, and I'm interested in hearing your views of ADHD as a disability. What does it mean to you, and how is it valuable in this context?
So I think that I came to that realization after being physically disabled.
Ah.
So when I had the traumatic injury, I ended up with two broken arms, like profoundly broken, two broken arms at the same time. And I was unable to use my hands for months.
Wow.
And I remember sort of, I had already had the mindset of like disability is not a bad word. We have friends who are physically disabled. And then learning that my child has autism and ADHD, I believe in removing the stigma around the world. Like, disabled only means that the world is not prepared or set up for someone in this position. That's how I view it, right? It doesn't mean that this person or myself aren't meeting the expectations of the world, as the world is not meeting our expectations and what we need. But when I was physically disabled and I started to use that word because I had to, because I'm like, oh, I'm disabled, I'm not able to do that. I'm not able to hold my fork properly for months and months and months. Couldn't wash my own hair, couldn't do, I couldn't pick my children up for almost 6 months. And it was going through that process and through the like physical therapy process and like seeing firsthand, like, how you understand something and you have empathy for it, but then when you go through it yourself, you really get the depth of it. You understand the depth of how it feels, that I really started to understand that, like, why are we making up cute words for what it really is, which is disabled? But all that means is that, again, the world is not prepared. Like, the world has not been set up to accommodate people who don't look or act the way that we think is quote unquote normal, or think, that way that is normal. And so that was kind of how I started to remove the stigma around the world, that word, in my own mind, and use it more in a way of being like, yes, I'm disabled, but like, that doesn't change anything. Doesn't make me less or better, or like less or more. It just is. Like, I just am, and that means that I may need things that are maybe not in the quote unquote norm that you're used to, and we can talk about that. And that's, how accommodations come up, how inclusivity comes up. It was a huge part of the nonprofit that I ran, was that we were very strongly trying to create a space that was inclusive and accommodating beyond just being inclusive, like wanting people to feel like it was a space where they could exist without needing to hide what they needed, and so it's been on my mind for a really, really, really long time. And then going through a physical disability really brought it to my mind in a different way. I mean, I still am to this day. Like, I still don't have full function in one of my hands. Well, hopefully surgery will fix that, but we'll see. But that's kind of how that came about, I would say, was just the idea that, like, I want to say it really started with one of my friends who is in a wheelchair, and just the way she talks about it and how she's like, why would I change? It is what it is. Like, she's a very matter of fact person, which is kind of funny. She's like, it is what it is. It's not a bad thing. It just is.
Yeah, and I really like the way that you view it as a definition of something about the world around us versus about us.
Right.
Because I had avoided the word disability since the start, mainly because I didn't want my kids to grow up thinking there was anything beyond their capacity. They may need to find a different way to do it, but it's not beyond them. And so for me, at first, at least until today, it sounded like a limitation and a barrier that I didn't want to instill in them. But I love your point of view because it helps me expand my definition of that word into something that can actually be empowering in a way. Yeah, I
And I
appreciate
think,
that.
when we told our son that he was autistic and had ADHD, he said, oh, like my friend Royal. And I said, yeah. And he goes, cool. Zero feelings other than, okay, cool. Because we had been in a world where that was a totally normal thing for someone to have a different brain, and that it was totally normal for someone to have different limbs, or to not be able to walk, or to be in a wheelchair, or to need a cane. Like, all of those things were completely normal to him. He was like, okay, that's just what they need in order to navigate the world. That's literally what he said to me once. Oh, they just need that to navigate the world. And
Wow.
and it, he's a very special child. But you know, it really, like, it was through that experience with him that it really shifted my focus, because and my thought process, because you know, I mean, it's the same thing about, like, well, we used to not want to say we were like a single woman, you know, like the way that we deconstruct words in order to reclaim them as something empowering versus something derogatory, you know, and I'm really down that rabbit hole in my life, so.
There's nothing quite like the wisdom that comes from kids.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. My 8-year-old has said some things to me that I look at him and I'm like, how, what, huh? He
I love
literally
it.
said to me yesterday, he's really into this Portuguese version of music called funk. He learned about from a kid at his school. I couldn't possibly explain it to you. I think I might be too old for it, but it was him. He was like, Mom, I really love when music is in a different language, because then I can really experience the music and not focus on the words. You know, it's not as distracting to me and it doesn't pull my focus. And I was like, who are you, 8-year-old? Like, but it's been so interesting to see him through, you know, the world that we've created, the people he's around, the way we approach everything, like him really have agency around speaking about how his brain works and advocating for himself has been really beautiful to see. And
So
also,
that.
it's taught me to advocate for myself, which has been super interesting.
Yeah, that is amazing. That you and your child really have helped each other learn about the world. That's I'm still just my brain is stuck on that. How beautiful it is when that relationship is so enriching for both people.
Yeah, I mean, I have believed since the day both my children were born that they were like a cosmic teacher sent to the world, because they really push. I saw somebody sent this to me the other day. I have another friend who lives out of state, and she has children who are also on the spectrum and who, you know, have very many different types of needs. And she had sent me something that was like, children with autism or with ADHD are sent to make the world and the people around them better. And I really believe that. Like, I really
Me
believe that
too.
my children are here, and the way that their brains work and the way that they think and experience the world is making me and everyone around them better, and to learn more and to be more compassionate and to remember that they I've always treated my kids like tiny people, like not kids, but tiny humans. And they've really reinforced that as they've grown. They're like, I have agency. I am my own person. The stuff they say to me, I'm sometimes like, I literally can't argue with that. So, okay. Like,
That is awesome, and I couldn't agree more. And being a mom is exhausting.
yes.
There's it is so exhausting on many, many different levels. And when we add in the exhaustion of owning a brain that is always on, it's like a recipe for absolute burnout, especially in this modern culture of both productivity and distraction in the same moment sometimes. How hard is it for you to find rest without guilting yourself over it?
Oh man, I'm absolutely terrible at that. That is one of the things that I am constantly working on, because I grew up in a very patriarchal family, and so it was always like the men sat and the women did, and also in a very religious family on top of that, which is again the women did and the men sat. So I really val my value to me growing up was always in what I could achieve and what I could do. And rest was almost like a bad word in our house. Like, you didn't, you, there was no relaxing. And then, of course, when I am relaxing, my brain is still going a million miles a minute, especially when I was younger and before I learned tools to try to calm it down, or bad coping mechanisms at times. And now as a mom, you know, I have two, you know, neurodiverse kids who one requires quiet and the other one loves noise, and I need a variation of both. And you know, I literally yesterday I was like, I'm going to sit on the couch for 5 minutes. I don't want to be bothered. Please go to the playroom, play for 5 minutes, and then I will come find you. And then, of course, that 5 minutes was when they needed everything from me. And I lost it. I mean, not in a crazy way. I was just like, I literally asked for 5 minutes, and you are constantly asking me questions. Do I need to set a visual timer right now? And they were like sobbing because mom was not available. And I felt guilty. I was like, I needed 5 minutes. And now I feel sad that I needed that 5 minutes. But at the same time, I teach them to advocate for what they need. So now I have to advocate for what I need, but I still feel guilty. And you know, it doesn't feel like it stops. I only recently was actually diagnosed with ADHD, like within the last like 3 weeks.
Oh,
I
okay.
actually got an official diagnosis, and I actually tried out Adderall, which has been interesting. I've found that it helps with the sensory overload, which is super helpful because that helps me from feeling so burnt out at the end of the day. And I also have found that I can, like, even last night, you know, just feeling like I was like, I'm tired. I have a lot of emotional upset from the children being upset today. I'm needing to decompress. I'm pretty sure the laundry can wait. Like, no one will die if the
Right.
laundry can wait. There was a phrase we used to say at the nonprofit that I ran, which is that no one is going to pass away from dust on the floors. So if we need to sit down for a few minutes before we sweep, that's okay. And I try really hard to remember those things that, like, if it's not a life or death situation, it can probably wait. And I utilize lists a lot. Like, I have constant to-do lists everywhere. Like, I put them in my phone, I transfer them to a sticky note, I put the sticky note on my mirror. Like, I need things directly in my face in order to feel like they're going to get done. But that was something that, like, journaling used to help me a lot. It doesn't really anymore. I don't feel as akin to journaling as I used to, but I do write. Like, if I ever have a thought and I'm like, I need to do this thing, I just write it down. I'm like, I don't need to go down this rabbit hole today. I can go down this rabbit hole tomorrow. I can go look up 500 things on TikTok on how to disco mirror something tomorrow. That's not important today. So trying to do that has been helpful. And also just reminding myself that I really advocate for my kids to have rest and to have the ability to say, I need a break. I need 5 minutes. I need my weighted blanket. I need this. I need that. I mean, we have a regulation chart in their room and they use it constantly. So,
Right.
like, if I'm advocating for them to do that, why would I not allow myself to do that? Like, we always have to be in our house, it is not do what I say, not what I do. Like, I really try to model the things that I want them to learn. And so that helps me sometimes is to frame it as almost like a task. Like, well, you're supposed to model this for your kids, so you need to give yourself rest.
Yep.
But I will say too, the one really important thing that I think has changed it for me is that I have a group of friends, women specifically in my life, who, and a partner to be fair, who are very like, hey, you're doing too much. Come over and hang out, chill, have a conversation, sit on your porch. Let me take the kids. Like, I have a group of people in my life who are very good at being vocal about, like, we know who you are and we want you to, like, rest and get what you need. And so, and we do it for each other. And I think that's really important, is community is such a huge part of, I think, how I've survived this entire experience of being a person.
Yeah, it is so important, especially when your community is so good at reflecting back to you what they're seeing and what they have seen to be helpful in the past, or maybe not so helpful. They can set up sort of guardrails so that you're not running yourself into the ground. And that's beautiful. That is the power of community right there.
Yeah. And the thing is, they've seen me burn out multiple times. Like, I've gotten to really bad spots in my life because of not being able to say no. And I had a year of no. When I got injured, I told myself that that year from my birthday on was my year of no. It was the year of saying no to things, of not saying yes, of doing less, of resting, of trying to heal, because I really wanted to not. I was grateful to not have lost my hands, but I also wanted them back.
Yeah.
wanted to, and it was exhausting. It's really, really, really hard. Physical therapy sucks, and it's exhausting, and it's mentally exhausting, because you feel like you're never getting anywhere until you are. And that's, and they warn you about that when you go in. I had an incredible physical therapist. She was the best, but it really drains you. And I knew that I would never get where I wanted to go if I didn't say no to things and prioritize what I needed for me. There was also the year that we got my child's diagnosis. It was just a lot was going on, and I knew that I needed to take a step back from the things that weren't as important, or I was just going to crash out again, which had literally gotten me where I was. So I was trying to do better, be better, for myself for the most part. And I'm glad I did that. And then the next year was my year of yes, which has been fun. So
That's great. Yeah, it's so important to do two things. Number one, to give yourself the permission to say no, preferably without having a traumatic injury to
I don't recommend
predate
it.
that. And also to recognize the cycle. As you just said, a time of no is going to be followed by a time of yes, and then comes another time of no. It's all cyclical. And just because something is either a yes or a no right now does not mean it's going to be that way forever. And I really love what you said too about modeling your own self-care for your kids. Because if you were telling them, well, you need to ask for what you need to advocate for yourself and not doing it, they would get this mixed message, and that would put a whole lot more stress on them than just mom taking a break for 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think it's been such a hard practice for me as someone who like really did not figure out how to like get out of the cycles that I was in from my childhood until I was like in my 30s. And like I'm not there. I wouldn't say I'm there, but I'm definitely more aware of them. I'm more capable. I do a lot of talking to my little baby inner child and making sure she's safe so that I can actually make legit adult decisions without feeling like I'm making them from fear. Because that's just something that's, that all of that guilt comes from the fear that we're not enough because we've never been acknowledged for who we are and how our brains work. And that's always how I felt. It's like I've always wondered, like, I'm so smart, but I can't keep a job for more than like a year, except for the one that I made for myself. Like, every
Exactly.
time I did my own business, I had never had a problem with it. It was always great and it was wonderful because I could do whatever I wanted. I could decide today I wasn't going to do that thing, or I could, I used to say that the nonprofit that I ran was an unsolvable problem and it was always a new thing every day. And that was great for my brain because it was new things to learn and, new people to meet and new problems to solve. And a lot of creativity, but like also hit the side of my brain that likes order and lists and procedures and all that. So it was great for me. But anytime I tried to do another job, I either ended up in charge and miserable because I hate being in charge because I don't understand people. I don't understand social cues the same way that people do because my brain doesn't work that way. My brain doesn't care. It's like, I just want to get the thing done. What are you talking about? Well, I will say too, and this is coming up now, thinking about these things, is that when I did talk to the psychiatrist, they recommended that I get an autism evaluation because they were like, well, and I was like, really? I mean, that wouldn't shock me at all because my child is, but looking back now, thinking about it, I'm like, oh yeah, I really just like didn't care about the social stuff as much. I just needed the thing to get done. And that makes a lot of sense. And so it's been a learning process of giving up, like saying to myself, like, your worth is not inside of what you do or who accepts you or whether or not someone understands that you think differently. Your worth is how you feel about yourself. And all of that guilt is rooted in the idea that if I don't do a thing, then someone else will be disappointed in me, or the world will be disappointed in me, or I won't meet this arbitrary standard that someone has set up in the world. And trying to let go of that and just know that like the only person I need to worry about disappointing is myself. Like, am I meeting my own expectations for what I believe is healthy and makes me happy? And that has shifted my focus a lot. Again, thank you, therapist. She's amazing. But it's been a really long process that I still am doing, you know, every day. 'Cause like even today I was on the phone with my husband, like I just feel so guilty that I can't take 5 minutes without the kids getting dysregulated. And he's like, I understand that feeling, but also that's actually not your fault.
Right.
Like none of that was your fault. It just happened to coincide. I'm like, oh, that's a fair thing to say.
Yeah, again, the power of community, especially when it's in your own home.
Yes. I do have an amazing husband. He's like the nicest human being in the world. So that
Oh.
does help a lot.
Yeah. And the story you were telling about the way that you grew up, it occurs to me that that's probably a big part of the reason that so many of us with ADHD would describe ourselves as late bloomers, or well, yeah, I guess that's the best term, because we feel like perpetual kids in some way, because we're still trying to fit those childhood roles, and we're still trying to make sure that everybody's happy with us and we're doing the right things. And we don't, there are some things that take us a little longer to figure out. Sometimes we get into our 30s and we get into therapy before we realize, huh, you know, in this situation, somebody's going to end up disappointed. It can be the other person or it can be me. Which way am I going to go with it in this context? So I appreciate that story a lot. I think it's valuable for people to hear.
I think too, one of the things that's been really interesting is that as I've worked on parts of myself, so as I've gone to therapy and deconstructed like how I was raised and all of the things that happened to me that were traumatic, how I like health things that have come up that I've had to deal with, I ended up in a psilocybin mushroom study for depression, which ended up curing depression. And then after that, like what as these things are falling away, these things that I've attributed things to, I'm like, oh. Well, that wasn't depression, that was ADHD. And then I was talking to a friend and she was saying that, you know, like when I started taking Adderall, that's when I realized I was autistic. 'Cause she was like, the things I attributed to my ADHD that weren't really there, like I didn't feel the same, like I realized they were the autism that was getting masked by the ADHD. And the way that that deconstruction happens, I mean, not for everyone, 'cause not everyone has 75 things on top of them, but I think that's always so interesting is that we just, you know, I just thought I was a depressed kid. And it's more likely I was a burnt out child. I was a burnt out child who wanted to please everyone because RSD is a real thing and I didn't want anyone to be mad at me and I didn't want anyone to be upset. And I just did everything I was told, even if it hurt me. And I'm sure that that caused all of the feelings of like hopelessness and not wanting to be alive when I was a child because no one was aware, we'll say aware, we'll be generous. No one was aware that those things were going on. And it just wasn't talked about the same way when we were kids. Women never, I mean, girls never had it when I was a kid.
Right.
Like there were, I did not know a single girl with ADHD growing up, not a single one.
Yeah, same. Yeah.
I mean, I knew boys, but they were always this very specific type of person, and it was very obvious, and they were always the problem kid or whatever. And I just didn't, that didn't feel right to me. And so, yeah, I feel like now that we're in this era of the world where we're just talking so much more and we're being more open about things and vulnerable, it's been so nice to hear other people's experiences and then be like, oh, interesting. Like I had
Yeah.
no idea what misophonia was. And then like, so one of my friends was like, oh, look at this video about this thing that I have. And I was like, wait, what? It's like, I have
Yeah.
that too. I didn't know that some people don't have inner monologues until recently. I thought that was just how brains worked. Nope.
Yeah.
So I think that like definitely the era of that I feel like I grew up in, just being someone who's like almost, literally almost 40, like it feels like that burnout was happening a lot earlier than I think I was even aware.
Exactly. And that's why we're here. That's exactly what this podcast is about, to have these conversations open to everyone and anyone to hear, so that we can continue opening doors and opening hearts and minds. So I really, really appreciate you being here to share your story and to open hearts and open minds. As we wrap up, I have just one more question for you, and that is, where would you really like to see yourself in your neurodivergent journey, let's say 3 years from now, what do you hope will be different or hope will have happened?
I really hope that I've had more self-acceptance with things that I need and not see them as inconveniences to people in my life, and to be able to advocate for accommodations that I need, or, you know, what I'm capable of, and be reasonable about that, in a compassionate way, and also without feeling any guilt about it, feeling like I've accepted myself enough that it doesn't feel like I'm hurting someone by saying, I just can't get to that today. You know, that disappointment isn't there, that I feel like I'm in a position with whoever I'm, you know, in my life working with, et cetera, that is acceptable. It's okay for me to say, I can't get to that today. I either need support or I need more time. And that, I think, is something that I hope for my kids too. Like, I hope that as they grow, that is something that is more available, and that people are more aware that, like, we can do that for people. We can say, let me take that off your hands, or let me give you a little more time. We don't have to live in a world where there are these arbitrary emergencies that aren't really emergencies, you know, like, not everything has to happen this exact moment. And I really want to embrace that. And I want to embrace that for myself, but also for everyone. Like, I want to feel like I can be that for other people as well. I can say, hey, let me take that off your hands, because I have capacity today. Or, you know, it's okay if you can't get to that, or, like, take the time you need. Like, I want to be that supportive person the same way that I want it for myself. I really believe in being for my community the thing that I think I need first. And that, I feel like, has served me well in the past. When I show up for the people in my life the way that I want to be supported, it always comes back to me when I'm in a supportive community. And so that is something that I'm really hoping to build more of, and also for myself, but also for my kids. Like, they need more than one trusted adult that can navigate these systems with them and be there for them. And I want them to have more and more people that understand it and can be there with them through it, and me.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Be the change. Yeah.
It's such a cliche, but it is so true, though.
Yes, it's cliche because it's true, I think.
Yeah.
Well, Gabby, thank you so much again for being here and for sharing. I just know stories like yours are helping other women know they are not alone in this. They are not broken. And there are different ways to do things that can include, and not just include, but invite and welcome everybody. Now, earlier you were mentioning to me something called the Atlanta Free Fair. I would love for you to share how people can find out about that, or how they can connect with you.
Yeah, so I am on socials. I'm Pants Off on Instagram. Long story, got it a long time ago. But I do work on an organizing team for the ATL Free Fair, which is only been around for almost 2 years now, founded by a very good friend. It's a mutual aid fair where it's rooted in joy, intergenerational joy, acceptance, and learning and art. So it's a seasonal thing. It happens about every 3 months. It's a completely free event where anyone can be there. You can contribute by teaching everyone something, doing yoga. We're having sound baths. You can facilitate conversations or support circles. You can teach mending. You can perform a music if you want to. There will also be a free sale, and we do food for free for everyone. And it's just a way of coming together as a community and supporting each other through joy and through connection. Something that I feel like we desperately need at this time. And I believe that the person who founded this event in Atlanta, I mean, this event, similar events to these are happening all over the country, which is beautiful. But the person who founded it in Atlanta, like, really embodies what it's about. Sasha is an amazing person. So she's passed the torch onto us, as myself, Lacey, and Zoe, as we've, you know, taken over the planning of it since she's out of the state now. And it's been a really beautiful thing to experience. So you can visit our website at atlfreefair.com. We're ATL Free Fair on social media. It's also linked in my bio on socials. And all of the links to either become a collaborator, volunteer. If you don't want to do something specific, you can just show up and help me put up tents on the day. We also have, a donation list. If you want to, you can donate cash, of course, but you can also donate canned goods or, items to the free sale. That's all listed on our website as well. So, I really hope that people will consider coming out. It's going to be May 16th in the spring this year, but we will have another one in a couple of months, in East Atlanta. So we're hoping to break our record, which was 380-ish people last time. So we really want to get to 400 people. And, I really hope everyone comes out and experiences just the joy of being together and feeling that acceptance and just getting to know some like really amazing humans who are rooted in like joy and resistance as well.
Amazing. Thank you again for your time, Gabby. It's been wonderful. I hope that you and everyone listening will remember that you are loved, you are worthy, and the world needs you exactly the way you are, not in spite of your differences, but because of them.
Thanks for having me.
Here's your lab kit for today. Three ideas from this episode that you can start using in your own life. Number one, we have the 5-minute boundary experiment. So just like Gabby was saying, set a timer for 5 minutes and explicitly tell the people around you, I am unavailable until this goes off. If interruptions happen, they probably will. Calmly repeat the boundary once without explaining or apologizing. The goal is not to perfectly execute this for you or for them. It's for you to practice holding that line without collapsing into guilt. Remind yourself that you have needs. Your needs are just as important as everyone else's. Second, we have the somatic reset. This is a guilt check-in. So the next time you feel guilty about resting, just pause and scan your body from the tip of your head, slowly all the way down to the tip of your toes. Notice where you feel tight or restricted, maybe heavy or sharp. This is where the guilt lives. It might be in your chest or your stomach or your throat or somewhere else. Wherever it is, gently place a hand there and just stay with that sensation for 60 seconds, maybe a minute and a half. You're not trying to fix it here, just placing a hand and observing how it shifts when you give it attention instead of reacting to it. And third, we have it can wait repatterning. Pick one non-urgent task that you might normally push through, something like laundry or email or tidying or making appointments, and intentionally delay it by 30 to 60 minutes. Now, this is not procrastination. Remember, this is repatterning. So during that time, write the task down somewhere visible so your brain doesn't have to hold it, and your brain knows you won't forget it. This is building evidence that not every single thing is an emergency, and you can come back to it, and you can have a system for holding on to the things that need to get done, and knowing that nothing falls apart when you pause. That's your ADHD Alchemy Lab Kit for today. I hope you will try one of these experiments and let me know how it goes. Thanks for listening to the ADHD Alchemy podcast. If you're nodding along and thinking, oh yeah, that's me, then please subscribe and share this episode with another woman who gets it. Your reviews help more women discover they're not failing. They're just wired differently. And that is a good thing, despite the challenges. Plus, I want to hear your story. Apply to be a guest at myadhdalchemy.com and join my free community at fitology.com/community. Those links will be in the show notes. Together, we can rewrite the ADHD shame story into one of strength. I'll see you next time.